These are all his children, man, as far as you can see. Hell, man, out here, we're all his children.
Could we, talk to Colonel Kirk?
Hey, man, you don't talk to the Colonel, well, you listen to him. The man's enlarged my mind. He's a poet, warrior in the classic sense. I mean, sometimes he'll, you say hello to him, right? And he'll just walk right by you, and he won't even notice you. And then suddenly he'll grab you, and he'll throw you in a corner, and he'll say, "Do you know that if is the middle word in life? If you can keep your head when all about you losing theirs and blaming it on you, if you can trust yourself when all men doubt you." I mean, I can't. I'm a little man. He's a great man. I should have been a pair of ragged claws scuttling across floors of silent seas. I mean,
stay with the boat.
Hey, don't go without me, okay? I want to get a picture.
Zondi Timoner, the director of Brand, A Second Coming, Dig, and We Live in Public, among other things. And you're listening to Film Wax Radio. Keep listening.
Hey everybody, Adam Shartoff here, host of Film Wax Radio. You're listening to episode number 441 of this podcast. Well, I'm posting this show Monday, November the 6th. Tomorrow's election day. Please go out and vote. Please. Whatever it takes, get out there and please vote. That's one of the messages from today's show is, you know, not only will you be able to vote, but tomorrow is the launch of FilmWax Radio's first ever Kickstarter campaign. Finally, it's all approved. It's all ready to go. All I have to do is hit that launch button, which I'm going to time with tomorrow, Tuesday, the 7th. So after you vote, check it out. Check out the campaign. Go to Kickstarter, search FilmWax shirt or Shartoff, my name, Adam Shartoff. And, you know, get involved. Help make FilmWax Radio a bigger, broader success than it already is. Get the word out. Help me help you. Help you help me help you help me again. You get the idea. Very excited. You can read all the details on Kickstarter as of Tuesday tomorrow. And, of course, I'll be back in a couple of days, with a Thursday with another episode of the podcast. I'm going to be doing a episode devoted to safe work environment for working and for gender parity, all these issues that are coming to a head. That's coming up on Thursday's show, episode number 442. But not to get too far ahead of myself here, this is a very special episode. We have on segment one, Lois Vossen, who is the founder and the executive producer for Independent Lens, that wonderful PBS documentary series. And it's, I think it's 16th season. Forgive me if I got the number wrong, but it's a new season anyway, and it's premiering tonight, Monday, November 6th on PBS with the documentary Chasing Train. The John Coltrane documentary. It will be premiering tonight at 10 o'clock Eastern Standard Time. Please check your local PBS listings for details where you live. There's going to be a few documentaries coming up. I think Shadow World, exploring the shocking realities of the billion-dollar global arms trade through those who perpetrate and investigate it. That's on November 20th. And then on December 18th, Supergirl, with past FilmWax Radio guest Jesse Orritt, her documentary. So, but tonight again, Chasing Train, the John Coltrane documentary. Chasing Train brings saxophone great John Coltrane to life as a man and an artist. You can go to pbs.org/independentlens and get all the information about all these documentaries and more. Lois Vossen is the guest in the first segment. She's what a wonderful woman. What a wonderful person. And I'm so glad to have met her and to do that. I can't wait. I'm serious. I cannot wait to bring her back on the podcast. That's how great this conversation went that you're about to hear. And then following that, and I'll be telling you more about it in detail before it, I'm very also extremely excited to introduce you filmmaker Nick Ebling, who made a documentary about Dennis Hopper And Dennis Hopper's soul brother. I don't know how else to describe Satya de la Menetou, except that very early on in Hopper's filmmaking career, once he became a filmmaker after, you know, this was just, I think, around the time of Easy Rider, he met this guy, Satya, who's going to be joining Nick, and who is also, in a sense, a co-subject of this documentary called Along for the Ride. He was riding shotgun, let's say, during all of these incredible adventures and during the life of Dennis Hopper. As a filmmaker, as an artist, photographer, so many hats that Dennis Hopper wore. We'll be back in a little while to talk about it in a little bit more detail and about the documentary and that it's currently playing at the Metrograph Theater in New York City. Okay, here first, Lois Vossen, who is, again, the founder. She founded PBS. Let's give her credit for PBS, too, while we're at it. She discovered PBS. I think she was on a vacation and was digging in the sand, and then she discovered PBS. No, that's not really what happened, but she will talk about what actually happened, which is that she got, I think, some funds from ITVS to put documentaries on television. And out of that sprang Independent Lens. So, we're going to bring on Lois right now. Here on FilmWax Radio. Okay, and then we'll be back in a little bit with the Along for the Ride.
They publish children's books.
Okay, very good. We want to give them a shout out. What's the name of the company?
Sourcebooks.
Sourcebooks. Very good. Thank you to Sourcebooks. Look them up at sourcebooks.com. We're going to think. So you're the, Lois, you are the executive producer of Independent Lens, and you founded it.
I did. I started the series 16 years ago.
16 years ago. What were you thinking?
What was I thinking? I had come to ITVS from Sundance, and the first year that I came to ITVS, we had 9 films at the Sundance Film Festival.
And well, for those who don't know what ITVS is.
It's the Independent Television Service. It's a unique organization. It's primarily funded by taxpayer dollars through the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. And it was created by independent filmmakers 25 years ago to fund and present independent documentaries on public media. The idea was that at the time, public media, to get on, you had to be a part of a series, an existing series, so there weren't a lot of independent voices. And there also wasn't as much diversity as the independent field represented. So ITVS was created through an act of Congress, it exists as a small revenue stream where CPB gives money to ITVS, and ITVS in turn gives that money to independent filmmakers.
They review and they judge the films based on whatever merits, and then they decide.
They have, in 25 years, funded over 1,400 films. Just a couple of weeks
ago. Let's go over those.
Oh, 1,400. Number 44. No. Two weeks ago, ITVS received the Governor's Award from the Television Academy. It's the highest award that the Television Academy bestows. And in its history, it's only given that award to 3 organizations that do nonfiction work, ITVS being the third. And earlier this year, ITVS received an Institutional Peabody Award for its body of work. And both organizations, the Peabody Organization and the Television Academy, singled out ITVS because of the quality of the work, but also because of their 25 years of commitment to diversity. Over two-thirds of the filmmakers that are funded are filmmakers of color, and over half the filmmakers are women, 51%. The staff is something like 68% diverse. The board of directors is something like two-thirds divorced. So diversity is really the key mandate of the organization.
Wow. Where are they based?
San Francisco.
Oh, they are.
And
ITVS
started out in St. Paul, Minnesota, ironically. Oh. They sort of put it right in the middle of the country. And then after 5 years, it relocated to San Francisco.
Practical purposes.
There was a larger documentary community in San Francisco.
At the time, that's right, yeah. Yeah, there's a lot of film festivals.
Film festivals in BayVac. And it was, there's a really thriving documentary community in the Bay Area.
Right.
So it sort of made sense, rather than being a big fish in a small pond, being another fish in another, you know, a larger pond.
Right.
So so I came to ITVS from Sundance. I had been working at Sundance for 5 years.
Oh, and it's programming?
I was the associate managing director.
Okay.
And so I managed the summer labs, and then I worked on the festival. And I programmed a film series at the Sundance Resort, a Cinematheque series. And so when I came to ITVS, that first year we had 9 films that went to the Sundance Film Festival, and only one of them got picked up for broadcast on PBS. And that seemed unusual to me. And so it became clear that we needed some sort of platform for those incredible documentaries. And POV existed, but they were only, you know, 13 films a year. That wasn't enough of a platform.
Yeah, right.
So in the years that followed, PBS agreed that there should be another venue for independent film. Documentary film on PBS. And so that's when we started the series.
So did you have in mind, since I'm actually talking to somebody who has the entire breadth of the life of the series right here with me, so I can ask these questions. Like, did you know early on an identity in mind for independent
life?
Because POV has theirs.
Yeah, absolutely. So, I mean, part of it was interesting because we didn't want to be POV because they're fantastic. They don't need us. They're themselves. And yet we swim in the same water. You know, we share some DNA. So the idea was, because we're also so large, you know, we're on for 9 months out of the year. So we have to work with programmers, public television programmers across the country, and have things for Christmas and for Hanukkah and for Easter and Father's Day. And so it was pretty clear that in addition to doing, you know, really important documentaries about social issues, that I also needed a larger breadth of films. So we've also been in the fortunate position to welcome in documentaries like Don't Stop Believin', which does have a social issue at it. It is about, you know, a man coming here and adjusting to American culture, and it's about immigration. Or even Muscle Shoals, which is primarily a music doc, but there's a very important story there about racism and, you know,
a cultural divide
terms of the musicians. And there's a great sub-story about all the musicians who came down and who had to stay, you know, in a different hotel, and they couldn't go to eat with the session musicians because they were black.
Right.
So, but it's also much more accessible because music is what primarily drives it.
I was trying to remember the filmmaker. I'm just blanking for a second, but there was, I'm not going to stay on this very long since my mind is a little slow going. I didn't have enough caffeine apparently. Sam Pollard's film.
Oh yeah.
Kind of explores this interesting relationship between the political and the musical cultural relationships that were happening at the same time in his most recent film, Two Trains Running.
Yeah.
So I'm just going to suggest that film for your series.
No, I've seen it and loved it. I love that film. And of course, I love Sam. We didn't take it only because Sam's other film is on the series. He directed a wonderful film. He's too prolific. Sam, you've got to slow down.
He keeps coming on the show. I'm just going to turn over, let him be the co-host.
Yeah.
Sam has got a new one with Sammy Davis.
With Sammy Davis. This is the thing. You can't stop him. Sam is one of my, obviously, not just one of my favorites. We joke that he's involved in every film, except like two. But his film that he co-directed with Ruben Atlas, Acorn, and The Firestorm is on that
Which
we funded.
So, Tribeca, I think, last.
Yeah, exactly.
Was it 2 years ago now?
Tribeca this past.
It was this past year, right?
Yeah. So, you know, we can't have it be independent Sam Pollard lens, sadly, you know, much as we'd love to. Yeah. So that's why we weren't able to fit that film in.
I've had a lot of documentary filmmakers on, so I see a lot of documentaries, and I know a lot of them. But
and they all talk
Ruben
about Sam.
Ruben has also been on, and Sam has been on, and Sam has been on, and I think I'm going to meet up with him at Woodstock in a couple of weeks.
Say hi for me.
I will probably have him on again. but that looks like a very entertaining documentary now.
It's wonderful.
Have you seen the Sammy Davis?
I didn't. I didn't get to Toronto this year. I had to be down in L.A., but I can't wait. Sam and I have talked about it a couple times since it premiered, and so I might get a chance to see it soon.
We can talk about the films you actually are having putting on as opposed to the ones you
let's
aren't.
Let's go back to that since we have 22 brilliant films.
But the ones
that
you have brought up, like I see the connections, and it's an interesting, you know, I did see Muscle Shoals, and you mentioned before that you were talking about
Don't Stop Believin',
which I also had on Ramona Diaz just the other day with her new film as well, which is called Motherland.
Which we ITVS funded.
But
it's going to be on POV. That happens a lot. ITVS funds films not just for independent lens, but also for POV, for American Masters, for Frontline, for American Experience.
All those great shows.
If you see great independent work on PBS, it's probably been
ITVS
touched by ITVS logo at the end.
Or in the credits, yeah.
Yeah, exactly. Joe Pfeiffer.
I should, if I make a trip out there, I should do a segment on.
You absolutely should.
Yeah, it makes a lot of sense since they've touched so many.
Yeah, 1,400 and counting.
Exactly right. Speaking of, do you know how many films have been on Independent Lens over the last 16 seasons?
You know, I did the number recently, but, about a year ago. The first five seasons, we had 29 shows each season. Then we dropped down to 26, and now we're at 22, so multiply that by 16. I didn't want to come up with there.
But because of now you have other platforms, or platform with the website.
Yeah.
You're also doing things there.
We're multi-platform series now, which is really exciting. In addition we've always had the feature docs, and then we've streamed the feature docs, of course, at pbs.org. But we began two really exciting new initiatives. About 3 weeks ago now, we launched Indie Lens Storycast, which is our digital series.
Yeah.
And it's Kareem and the gang who've been working really hard on that content, Kareem Ahmad. It is short form digital series. They run 5 episodes, 6 episodes, 8 episodes.
Right. Also known as web series.
To our average listener out there
user.
That we love you.
If
you're
out there and you use the internet, you may want to check this out.
The web series.
Storycast.
Yeah. They're Indie Lens Storycast. They're really great. There's one about a gay couple in adoption. They adopt a child out of foster care. There's one about black men and fatherhood. One called Iron Maidens, which is a great film about a group of girls in a science lab who want to be engineers.
Sounds like Hidden Figures.
Yes, exactly. A little bit like it, very much so.
Right.
And one about Real Housewives of Karachi, which is sort of like a takeoff on.
Good marketing there.
Yeah.
And I also want to mention, I don't know if you were going to bring this up, but the We Are All Newtown, because I had on those filmmakers.
Kim and Maria. Well, that's our second new initiative. About 2 years ago, we began working with journalism partners. And so we create short-form journalism pieces that exist with the New York Times, the Washington Post, Mother Jones, Salon, The New Yorker, and then also with local newspapers. So it's different forms. Like with Newtown, we worked with Kim, and she created a 3-part web series called We Are All Newtown, which looks at urban, suburban, and rural gun violence. And we published that with People magazine. And now we're republishing it this week with USA Today. Because my goal there was to reach beyond the divide. And it was right at the time when fake news was just, you know, all anybody was talking about. And the fact that people outside our bubble, whatever our bubble is, didn't trust the New York Times. And so I thought, if we're going to talk about gun violence, I don't want to talk in an echo chamber. So people, and now USA Today, really reach across the country and talk to, you know, a wide range of people. But we also want to do things and do things with the New York Times. We also are doing what we call originals, where we're giving filmmakers money to create something completely original. For example, we had a film on Independent Lens about 8 years ago called Me Facing Life, Centoya's Story. It was about a young woman who was 16 years old when she killed her John. And she went to prison with no chance of parole. And the filmmaker, as these wonderful independent filmmakers do, continued to follow the story, Dan Berman. And he kept going back to Tennessee. And there wasn't quite enough to make another follow-up film, but it was perfect for this journalism initiative. So we sent him back, and he went back into the prison and shot and made 7 short films.
Yep.
And then a journalist from the Tennessean wrote 7 stories to follow it, because what's happening is in Tennessee, they're now looking at rewriting their laws on juvenile sentencing. And it's based on our documentary. A Republican congressperson saw the documentary and said, this is crazy.
Yeah.
And so it gave that filmmaker an opportunity to update that story, and also a local reporter to really embed it in local reporting. So with the Journalism Initiative, we're really trying to take this incredible content that these very smart filmmakers are making and break it down into shorter bites and get it out onto new platforms, in this case, journalism outlets. So between that and StoryCast, we're really expanding our work digitally.
Oh, very much so, it sounds like. It's exciting. It must be a little bit confusing for the tried and true documentary filmmakers who, you know, been out there for decades and realizing, now, wait a minute, I now need to think about the structure, the format of my story. And then what does that make me? Am I still a documentary filmmaker? Because now I'm working closer to something that most people might think of as journalism. And not that the two are always separate.
Yeah,
of course, we know that they haven't been.
Yeah, I would make the case that they're less separate than people think. I mean, our filmmakers, while some films have a very strong point of view, all of our filmmakers are wedded to truth and fact-checking and deep, deep reporting. And in some ways, they know the subject matter. I won't say more than reporters, but if you look at somebody like Kim Snyder, she spent 4 years making Newtown. I mean, she knows as much about gun violence and trauma, post-gun violence, as any reporter knows. I mean, one could say she's an expert at it, having spent 4 years embedded in that community that was trying to deal with that tragedy. And so now when something like Las Vegas happens, there are very few people who know more about what that city's going to go through than people like Maria and Kim, having been so immersed in that subject matter. So I don't think of them as, I mean, they're very akin to journalists, although independent documentary filmmakers work very differently than journalists. I think that they've been forced to think about this format question for much longer. As soon as digital became a reality and people started watching things on their cell phones, filmmakers had to start to think about, how do I keep somebody captivated for longer than 3 minutes? And especially younger audiences that are more and more wanting things encapsulated. So I don't think all the forms coexist in a wonderful way. People want a deep dive. A lot of people want to see an 83-minute film. Some people want to see a 53-minute version of that film.
Right.
And some people want to see that story told a different way through a web series that is maybe told 20 minutes, but it's broken up episodically.
Well, finally, there's just platforms available which have enormous potential audiences, as opposed to if you had made a, you know, some sort of serialized thing that wasn't on broadcast television 10 years ago, you know, you'd be, it might lend itself to that format, but it doesn't mean anybody's going to see it. Now it's changed.
Yeah.
We do watch them, as you said, on our phones, tablets, smart TVs, smart, you know.
I think the difference is in the storytelling, that independent filmmakers, by and large, want to tell character-driven stories, and they want to go deep inside the character. At least that's what sets our films apart.
It's going to say, it sounded like your independent lens was interested in the journalistic approach, which maybe is a deep nuance, because
a deep nuance is a great way to think of
approaching a story, whereas it's interesting because leading up to the last, I'd say, few years, there seemed to be a trend, and it's not that it stopped. It certainly hasn't. There still is a trend of documentary filmmaking, which is trying to come across using narrative
techniques
to tell their story, even so much as like getting into genre filmmaking with a documentary.
Something like Tower, where Tower's they use deep animation.
Example. Right, animation as opposed to, or, I mean, this is an old documentary at this point, Bacropsy, where, you know, they use the horror film genre
absolutely
to kind of set up their film.
Yeah.
But those are not necessarily, I use that word, the films that would end up on independent lens, per se. Like,
well, maybe. I mean, the great thing about
have Tower, though, so.
Yeah, absolutely. And I,
very profoundly moving.
Yeah,
film.
Keith pitched me that film in a bar in Austin. Yeah. We had funded his previous film, Eyes of Me, which was on independent lens, and we got together in Austin, and that was 4 years ago, and he had this idea, and so this is what, 2013, something like that? And I could see it immediately in my head, the animation, knowing his work with animation previously.
Rotoscope, right?
Yeah. And the idea that I said you want to make a film that will speak beyond the choir. You want to make a film about gun violence that's going to look really different. And he said, that's it, exactly. And so we gave him a little bit of seed money, and he went away and did R&D, and then he came back and we gave him production funding. And working with him, I mean, he's such a joy. He's a mensch, among menches. But he... that film is, to me, a perfect independent lens film because it's totally character-driven. Claire and, you know, Officer Martinez and all the people in the film really tell that story, but he's using incredible narrative techniques, animation, to bring that story to life. It's one of, you know, it's one of those films that really did bring a different audience to a social issue, which is, if you asked me earlier what the goal was for the series, that was the goal, is to go beyond an echo chamber, to really go beyond people who thought, I want to watch documentary films. For me, it's a really great win when, you know, when I go home to Minnesota and my brothers and my cousins and people I know from high school tell me they watch something on independent lens, because they don't watch every week, but they will watch certain things. And that's who I want it. We want to reach. Because we want to spark conversations in those. People say, what's really rewarding about my job? And working with filmmakers is always the number one thing. But the second thing is getting emails from people. And I remember in our first season, we had a film called Daddy and Papa by Johnny Simons. And it was about two gay men who adopt children. Mm-hmm. And so it looked at, which at the time, you know, was pretty revolutionary and controversial, gay adoption. But I remember I got an email the following morning after the broadcast. This woman in Mississippi said, I believe in God, I believe in the Bible, and it says homosexuality is wrong, but I watched your film and those two men seem like such loving parents, and they seem to be such devoted to parenting. It's made me rethink everything I've ever believed about that. Mm-hmm. I mean, that's what we want to do. We want people to think about things in a new way. So that was really the goal from the onset, with this very, very deep overriding commitment to diversity.
She may have been predisposed to want to think in different ways. And
she turned it on and watched it.
Yeah, exactly.
But something moved her to go from point A. So now maybe the next day at dinner, she mentioned it to somebody else.
Right.
And that's how we led to marriage equality. I mean, it's people talking about people.
So you're taking credit for marriage equality.
I think I feel as though I deserve at least 90% of nothing. Yeah, exactly. Thank you, Adam. I'm going to add that to my resume, if that's okay with you, and I'm going to attribute it to you.
Oh, sure.
If that's okay.
Leave like a little asterisk
and
or
at the bottom.
Yeah.
You know,
FilmWax Radio for more.
Yeah, absolutely. For all future, you know, if you need to quote this in a thesis, for example. Yeah, when they write the history of the Gay Marriage Act.
That's right. I'm literally a footnote.
You and I.
Or footnotes, literally.
Literally footnotes in history. Yeah. We're about to get kicked by that if we don't. Yeah.
Oh my gosh. Well.
Yeah.
It's hard though. It's hard for me to believe that because I just don't believe you can put the genie back in the bottle. But
no,
this is another. This is another.
That's a whole other conversation.
Yeah.
But you know, ITVS had done, just for a second, it made me think. Mm-hmm. They did a very incredible international initiative a few years ago after 9/11. Sally, our president, realized there was an opportunity to bring that we as a country needed to know more about the world and to understand why things like that were happening. And so she was able to raise a significant amount of money, and we funded international filmmakers.
Yeah.
That, unfortunately, the funding ran out and it didn't get renewed. But over the course of that 7 years, we funded 168 films from 32 countries. And the point of it was that people will be moved by other people's stories. That if you just read the headlines and if you just listen to talking heads, you become numb and you walk away. But if you actually see a child in India who's been trafficked, or if you see a child in Africa who has AIDS, or if you see a woman in Afghanistan, you know, who has had her rights taken away from her, you then connect to that issue and you actually feel, I can help change that, or I right. want to change
so
that.
So shouldn't we remove them, the news shows, and put on documentaries well, all you know, through those broadcast hours?
I don't want to say we should remove the news,
but
I do.
Shouldn't there be an independent lens channel?
Yes, absolutely. There should totally be.
Do we really need
Fox?
With.
No.
Or MSNBC? Or, you know.
What I do find, and I don't know if you agree with me, but, you know, I feel like now whatever news I watch, I'm listening to one side most of the time. It's hard to find news. I'm going to give a shout out to my colleagues at PBS NewsHour because I think they're doing a phenomenal job of trying to stay in the middle and listen to both sides and, you know, still do accurate reporting that isn't fake news, which is hard these days. But I think that's the hard thing. News right now has become so polarized. Even when the news becomes this polarized, I think it's what we have seen is a definite increase. Our ratings have gone up the last three seasons. In a world of television where everybody's ratings are going down, our ratings are going up. It has to have news, PBS NewsHour, as have Frontline, because I think people are really eager to find something that they can actually trust and dissect and learn from. So we feel as though, and it all goes back to the independent filmmakers.
I mean, that's also related to the fact that like the subscriptions for the New York Times and other has gone up.
Yeah, people are looking for something that they can hold on to. And I think the other thing about independent filmmakers, and I certainly know this is true as well as, you know, for all of my colleagues who work in this field, they have a sort of a knowledge of the ground truth. I mean, they'll be on a story years ahead of the story. I mean, we look now and we have five films from, you know, 2 or 3 years ago that were about gun violence sort of peaking because filmmakers were talking about that. Or, you know, so they're usually ahead of the game is the ironic thing, because they're really out there on the ground hearing what's bubbling up in communities. And so they're doing stories on those things. And so we can be very timely. Last season, well, when everybody was thinking that a different person was going to be elected president, we brought in two films on the KKK. And then it turned out they were extremely relevant in that moment.
Birth of a
Movement and Accidental Courtesy. And they both, we had them pegged for broadcast in January and February.
Just days after.
It was literally right at the moment, at the time. And so that credit goes back to the filmmakers who have their pulse, because they're out there looking for these great stories.
Yeah. And they're out there, as you say, they're not spending their time, energy on other media, like what the general media is telling, it's that story, but they're listening to the stories that are actually out there in the zeitgeist.
Absolutely. And, or you look at somebody like Raoul Peck, who 10 years ago, I mean, had always been in love with Baldwin, and 10 years ago got the rights and then let that simmer and simmer. And then we became involved with the film. I think I met Raoul 5 years ago and we funded it something 4 or 5 years ago. And that came out right in the moment of the zeitgeist. But I don't think those are accidental. I really think that's because these filmmakers like Raoul are really in tune to what's happening in the culture. I mean, Raoul, when I we were at Toronto to premiere I Am Not Your Negro, and he and Hebert said, Mr. Trump is going to be elected. And this was in September. And I said, Raoul,
come on.
Come on.
I would have been. I have to admit,
Raoul, you're not. I said, that's not going to happen. He said, yes, Lois, it will. And then he gave me his reason why. And his reason made total perfect sense. No, he said, if you have Fox News growing and growing and growing in popularity, and what is on Fox News is what is on Fox News, that energy, that anger, that divisiveness, that backlash to Obama has to emerge somehow, and it's going to emerge as your next president. And I was just like, it can't be true. And then 2 months later, I had to call him and say, and he said, you know, sorry, Lois. But he knew.
I'm sure he didn't enjoy being right that time.
Yeah, exactly.
He would have probably appreciated being wrong.
Yeah, exactly.
Proven wrong. Yeah.
But I think, and again, it's just because ear to the ground.
Can you ask him about, like, the next election?
Yeah, exactly.
I'm curious.
I'm going to say, Raoul, who should we run? You know, he lives in Paris part of the year.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
But
he's here part of the year, too. So that's why he's so immersed in both.
Right. Well, he's Haitian by birth, so he speaks French, right?
Yeah. Yeah, he does.
And his brother...
Hebert.
Worked on, that's Hebert? Okay. Yeah. I wasn't sure. Okay. Yeah. So
you should have him on the show.
Well, I was going to... it was like one of those things where, I mean, clearly this was going to be a major documentary of the year. So,
well, we're broadcasting it finally.
Well, so, and I saw it.
Yeah.
Yeah, no, I did. I saw it. So let's. This is a good point to talk about the new season. Season. This is season 16 starting, as I believe there's going to be a mini launch period, and then you're gonna the main season will take place at the beginning of the year of 2018. But you've got, we've touched on a couple of films already, I think. But what else have you got?
We've got an incredible lineup this year. I'm so proud of it. Yeah. Dolores by Peter Bratt is coming.
I don't know that one.
Oh, it's an incredible look at the life of Dolores Huerta, the incredible organizer who worked hand in glove with Cesar Chavez. Mm-hmm. And she's alive at age 87, is more vital and more a spitfire. And her story about how she organized the Farm Workers Union, yep. And just her life in general. And a lot of people, I mean, obviously people who listen to this podcast will know her, but people across the country don't know her. And it's a result of misogyny and racism. Mm-hmm. I mean, she is equally responsible for the work that Cesar Chavez did, but her name didn't get on the, you know, on the
marquee.
Yeah. Even though she got, you know, beat up and almost killed in a protest once. But she now has her own foundation, and she's continuing to do this remarkable work, primarily in California, but it's national, and it's around everything from schools and, you know, allowing students to have equal access in schools to, you know, new work on LGBT issues. I had the incredible good fortune of interviewing her last week because she lives in California, and so she's been doing a lot of press for the theatrical release. Our friends at PBS Theatrical have it out in theaters right now, and they're doing a lot of that in our office. And so then we did a little conversation with Dolores just for our staff.
Right.
And she's
nice.
She's phenomenal.
And where are you guys based?
We're in San Francisco.
You are? Okay.
Yeah. Uh-huh. I asked her, do you consider yourself an icon? And she said, no, it's funny. I'm an ICANN. And you know, she created she was the person who created the phrase "Yes, we can" that Mr. Obama then took for his campaign. No, so it's now legally trademarked with the Farm Workers Union because that's where she was at the time that she. So if anybody uses that trademark, that phrase now, they have to get the trademark from the Farm Workers Union. She's phenomenal. So that's coming. We have a film, film called Rat Film. Theo's film, yeah. Theo Anthony.
He did the podcast.
Yeah, he's wonderful. I hate rats, but I love that film. Can't get enough of the rats in that film. We have, of course, I Am Not Your Negro, Raoul Peck. Right. It's masterpiece. Mm-hmm. We have, launching this season is Chasing Train, John Seinfeld's film on John Coltrane's life and legacy. And it's really about the impact of Coltrane as the man. Mm-hmm. It is about him as an artist, of course, because he was so groundbreaking in his work. But it's really about his legacy in the community. Then we have Shadow World, which is a remarkable film that looks at the international arms trade. We have a lot of films this season that are about race and social justice, including The Force, which is in theaters right now. Pete Nix's film, which we funded. And when we did his previous film, The Waiting Room, so he's just been a part of the family.
I know it's part of a trilogy.
Yeah.
His next one's on education.
Exactly. He actually wants to do four.
Oh, well, four makes a greater trilogy than three.
Exactly. So we'll see, but now he's off directing a narrative film in Hollywood, so we're going to lose him for a while. Yeah, he just got hired to direct a narrative film. But we have Nan Fu Wang's remarkable film I Am Another You. She is a brilliant young talent.
I saw that. Yeah, so something.
It was at South By, and then it's been on the festival circuit. It's also in theaters right now. We have a ton in theaters. Supergirl, which is in theaters right now.
Jesse Orlett.
Exactly.
Yeah, she did a show. I'm telling you.
We have Unrest by Jennifer Brea. Is Unrest premiered at Sundance. The filmmaker has chronic fatigue syndrome.
Okay.
And so the film is about her struggle with chronic fatigue syndrome. And it's a really remarkable film because she kind of bears all. I mean, she really took it to the mat, so to speak. And so it's a remarkable film about that illness and about resilience and also about medical science and when we deny people who say they have something. Because people just said, you're crazy. There's nothing wrong with you.
Yeah, I understand that.
Yeah, you can't be that tired. Just get out of bed.
Right. Yeah. If you can't see it, it's not there.
Exactly.
Yeah,
it's not there. Yeah, so that's a big part of the film. And then a great film called Serve Like a Girl by a female filmmaker named Leslie Hesloff. We have Untold Tales of Armistead Maupin by Jennifer Kroot, which is the story of Armistead Maupin.
Sounds like a local filmmaker.
Well, she's in the Bay Area, ironically. Mm-hmm. But, you know, he wrote Tales of the City, which became this touchstone.
She's in San Francisco, right?
National, you know, story about gay rights.
Yeah.
Which also Serve Like a Girl is this incredible story about female veterans and homelessness among female veterans. Oh, okay. But Lisa has crafted a documentary, despite that heavy topic, that is totally watchable and actually funny and warm and heartbreaking, and really makes you understand the issue of homelessness among female veterans in a way that you would never otherwise sort of captivate and stay with. I mean, these women are remarkable. They're all competing for the Miss Veteran USA pageant. So it's a beauty pageant is sort of the backdrop, but we really actually go to them in Alabama and Michigan and Maryland and all over the country, Northern California, and watch these women who are dealing with what their life is like after being veterans.
Right.
So it's just a remarkable lineup. There's, you know, 22 incredible films coming.
It's quite a large number of films, and it's even lower than it used to be, as you said. So it starts in October?
Yeah, we start in 2 weeks with Chasing Train is on.
And that's the 16th season premiere.
Yes, that's our season premiere, and then we follow that up with Shadow World and Supergirl, and then in January we go on with Untold Tales and Unrest and The Force and
on and on.
Yeah.
And for those who also want to, you can go onto the website. You're usually streaming a couple of your catalog documentaries, as well as I think we touched on the three-part series. We are All Newtown.
Yeah, all of those
is available for streaming.
Yeah, all the stuff on the website. We stream all of our films for 2 weeks after the broadcast, so you can always catch it for pbs.org/independentlens, and then we bring them back. You know, so this summer we just had a 6-week streaming series, and again this winter when we're dark for PBS Pledge Months, we'll do another streaming series.
And how quickly can you do that if like something germane comes up in the media, like in the news?
Great question. We have at times turned it around really quickly.
Yeah,
like we had a film on Jehovah's Witnesses, and when Prince died, he was a Jehovah's Witness.
Oh, I didn't know.
Yeah, so we brought that back right away because people were talking about, there was so much confusion about his death at first, and you know why he didn't have the surgery, and did he have a surgery, and did he use the right pain medication, and all of that. And our film on Jehovah's Witnesses has a whole section about their beliefs about surgery. So we can sometimes turn it around and get it back online really quickly.
Yeah.
It depends on the rights and if the filmmakers have also sold digital rights to some of our, you know, other platforms, like, you know, the other platforms. Like right now, we're, you know, we would love to bring back some of the films that look at gun violence, obviously, like Tower and Newtown.
Yeah.
But if you can't catch the whole film, you can see these shorter journalism shorts that are also on our website.
Mm-hmm.
And then, of course, there's IndieLens Storycast, which is the new digital, as you said, web series that's streaming. So we have content on our website all the time that people can come to.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, it's always there.
Terrific. Well, I'm so glad this all happened. You know, you should have been on ages ago.
I should have been on ages
ago. I've been doing this for six or seven years. And
well, you'll have me back. We'll come back.
We can talk
about, you know, later in the season. The show's coming later in the season.
Sure.
But it also sounds like you have so many of our filmmakers on that you're already diving deep
and
into.
Yeah, and some of them, the ones that I haven't, are just because of timing or whatever. They were supposed, like a Raoul Peck, I certainly had the opportunity to pursue it. And I, you know, whatever reason, it's some things just end up falling through the cracks.
The interesting thing about our films, and is that they have theatrical. Well, first of all, they're in festivals.
Right.
So some of them, you know, are out doing publicity, obviously, for the festivals. Right. Then they have their theatrical release. So there's another wave of press. And then there's broadcast.
Yeah.
And sometimes in between, there's, you know, a digital thing wedged in there, too. So they kind of are out there for a long period of time, which can be a good thing for the film and exposure. Sometimes it ends
not
up being.
Making other films.
Well, that's the thing.
Not earning.
Yeah. I just yesterday, I was meeting with a wonderful filmmaker who we're doing a film with that he's about to finish, and he has a new project. And so we were talking about that new project, and I said, wow, that sounds like an Indieland story cast. And he's like, so he wrote me last night, and he's like, yeah, now I'm thinking about it. Maybe it's not a feature film. Maybe it's a it's a web series. And the other thing that he said was, when this new film comes out, I don't want to spend 3 years doing publicity on it, because some filmmakers end up talking about a film for a very long time because they come so embedded in that content, in that issue, and they become these experts. So I think you have an opportunity to talk to filmmakers at so many phases.
Sure. I mean, a lot of them start foundations, and after their film hits, you know, really creates a cult, you know, has a cultural impact, you know, and then they are sort of all of a sudden responsible for
exactly.
Or they have a sense of responsibility enlarging is that the word?
Expanding
what they're able to do.
Who knows about it? Yeah. How did you get into this?
Oh, you can't ask me questions. Well, I was programming actually locally in Brooklyn. Actually, I was kind of doing my own series, and then just the very short version is there's a brand new internet radio station.
Oh.
I mean, and I was sort of part of the first generation. I met the people that were doing it, and they said, you should do a film related interview show. So it started as an internet radio show because I said yes, and I didn't really. I'm glad in a way because I worked out a lot of the kinks when no one was listening, essentially. Because I don't mean any disrespect to those people. They were, you know, they're still around, and I'm sure they have a much larger audience now. But I mean, nobody was tuning into my show. I mean, just didn't make any sense. So I because of that, I realized I can, you know, podcasting was just beginning to really emerge as a real
thing.
It wasn't just a clearly, it wasn't just a flash in the pan, whatever. So I just switched over to podcasting.
Right.
And then it also freed me up in a lot of ways, of course, you know. So that's how I did. So it's just like become this bigger thing. I can't.
You can't stop it. Can't stop yourself.
I would quit, but I just feel like I'm in too deep or something.
Well, I mean, it's funny you should say that because there are more great films than ever.
Yes,
more
true.
Great projects come in every day.
Yeah.
Just keeping up with the volume is probably the hardest part of the job.
Sure,
and
sure.
Every filmmaker that I've worked with has another great project after that project. So when you ask me how many films we have, the first thing I thought of was, oh my God, and all of those, they're new films because the audience has grown so much for documentary film.
Yeah.
And the brand of independent documentary film is at an all-time high in terms of people knowing about it, both from broadcast as well as from digital and film festivals and, you know, those that pop out theatrically like I Am Not Your Negro. And so there's no end to it. I mean, it's just, the form of storytelling. I joke that in the 50s, everybody wanted to be a writer. In the 60s, everybody wanted to be a rock musician.
Right.
And now everybody wants to be a storyteller, a documentary filmmaker. Everybody I meet, they're like, oh my God, I'm working on this thing about my grandmother. You know, she was or can you make the film about my uncle? He once did this. Yeah. I mean, everybody feels like it's this accessible genre.
It's true. Well, your phone really does go a long way to help feed that, you know, because you can document so much with just an iPhone.
Yeah, people are filming everything, and we are sort of consuming everything.
Right.
One could say maybe too much.
You can you can shoot and distribute in a matter of minutes if you have a following on YouTube. But my mother was in decline with dementia, and it took a while to figure out what was going on. And then at some point, I just felt like I need to show a doctor, or I need to show people what she's going through. And she was at an agitated stage, but way before it became an extreme situation. So, and for some reason, part of her frame of mind wasn't tuning into the fact that I was holding a phone in front of her like this.
Oh, yeah.
Maybe one time she said, what's that? Like, but she didn't notice it. She couldn't divide her focus on from me to that as well. So, and then I just watched, you know, over time, I just took hundreds of, you know, because I was spending a lot of time with her, and And I they're mostly very short clips, but I have like just lots of them. And then they backed off it for a while because the plateau of where she's been is pretty steady for a long time.
Well, this is one of the things I love most about the work I get to do is yeah. I'm sort of a little expert on a lot of things.
Me too. Yeah.
And we had this great film called You're Looking at Me Like I Live Here and I Don't, which is about Alzheimer's.
Yeah.
And one of the things I love to do on Independent Lens is have big films that, you know, maybe had a bigger budget or the filmmaker is very well known. But right. every season.
Alan Berliner.
Yeah. Alex Gibney. Kinds of people. But.
I was thinking he did one on Alzheimer's.
Yeah, yeah. But we also, every season, are really proud to have at mm-hmm. least five or six films by first-time filmmaker.
Wow.
This is their very first film. Mm-hmm. And. Because they're these little gems, and right. that was one of those films. This filmmaker who really went into a senior citizen home and followed around this woman who has Alzheimer's.
Yeah.
And it's so touching.
It's like such a no-brainer, but it's so simple, but it's so powerful.
It is so powerful.
What's their name?
His name is Scott Kirschenbaum, and it's...
I know Gail Kirschenbaum.
Oh, it's just so remarkable, this mm-hmm. small little film.
Yeah.
I mean, it's just stayed with me so much that years later, I still think of scenes in that film. So for me, that's one of the great things about Independent Lens is to really have an incredible range of filmmakers.
Sure. I do the same thing with this.
Yeah.
I have on Alex Gibney, but I'll also have on Jesse Orritt.
Yes, exactly. Exactly.
For me, it's a pleasure to.
I think it's important because all those voices are what is creating this river of incredible filmmaking.
And you don't know where the most powerful moments are going to be shot by Michael Moore or by, you know, some first-time filmmaker.
Exactly.
Or by, you know, it's no way of telling.
Yeah, I mean, Theo from Rat Film, I mean, he has been doing commercials. He's been doing great work. He obviously has an incredible cinematic eye.
Right.
The idea that he would make a film about, you know, redlining in Baltimore through rats.
Through the story of the rats.
Yeah, that's just... phenomenal.
Yeah, it's sophisticated. Yeah,
it's very smart and it's very visual and it's, you know, it pushes the boundaries in terms of what people will expect. I mean, he very deliberately, as you know, named it Rat Film because mm-hmm. we want people who wouldn't normally watch a film about redlining, mm-hmm. They might come to a film called Rat Film.
Yeah.
You know, I mean,
yeah.
that's brilliant to me. That's subversive.
Right.
That's like that's as subversive as the issue, as the episode of Blackish I saw last night.
I didn't see it.
I got to see. But that's subversive in the sense of tantalizing the viewer with something so smart.
Yeah.
And yet they're not even aware of how much they're learning and seeing and being exposed to and their minds being opened up in all kinds of ways.
It's a good place to leave it.
Excellent.
You have to turn back the office to the rightful...
Yeah. the rightful owner here at Sourcebooks.
Yeah.
Sourcebooks.com, I believe you said. Yeah, that's
Google
a guess. Total guess. But they were kind enough to lend us this office, so we are indebted
for
that.
Thank you. It was really great to sit with you.
It was great talking with you. Thank you so much. And thanks for having on so many great filmmakers and for making their stories amplified.
Right back at you.
Okay. Bye.
Again, Nick Ebeling is a filmmaker. It's this wonderful, wonderful, beautiful documentary. It does lean on some archive, but also we have Satya Delamanattu to kind of guide us. He's sort of our navigator, if you will, through the story of this part of Dennis Hopper's life, which the film mostly focuses on, I would suppose to say, the most intense period of Hopper's career when he was coming out of making Easy Rider, which was this huge, huge, ginormous success, right? Changed movies. And I'm not exaggerating when I say that. The studio system was dead, and here was the new movie-making system. These guys, and of course Dennis Hopper came from the studio. He came from making movies with James Dean, toward the end of that whole period, and then went on to make Easy Rider with Dennis Hopper and Jack Nicholson. Of course, now he had Final Cut based on the success of Easy Rider, so now he wanted to make a movie called The Last Movie, which I believe he was shooting primarily in Taos, New Mexico, unless I'm mistaken. Anyway, what happened there, of course, we're going to talk about. And then through a whole trajectory here, the period where Dennis Hopper, just check it out. I mean, yeah, again, we mentioned Easy Rider. We mentioned the last movie. Do we mention Apocalypse Now, The American Friend, and Out of the Blue, right up to his kind of comeback, if you will, because he was having a difficult time, but it's Blue Velvet. Let's call it the primary focus of the film is over that period of time. Here we go. This is Nick Ebling and Satya Delamanitu here on Film Wax Radio. Again, their film is called Along for the Ride. It's right now. It's already out. I didn't have time when I met with them, I think on Friday. I didn't have time, of course, to put this up any sooner. But please, please go out and see this film. Again, Along for the Ride at the Metrograph Theater. Check out local listings. It'll be playing in L.A. in December. We'll keep you abreast of it. We'll talk more about it. I had a wonderful time with these guys. We all had a wonderful time. We were talking about movies and Dennis Hopper. What gets better than that? It's perfect. Perfect subject for the Film Wax Radio. Okay, we'll be back after this wonderful segment with these guys to wrap things up. Thank you very much.
How were you difficult in the old days? Did you do marvelous difficult things?
Which area do you want to get into?
I'm Satya Delamanitu. For decades, I was Dennis Hopper's right-hand man, a.k.a. El Hombre Indivisible. Dennis affected world culture.
The star, the writer, the director, everything he could be, he was, and he is.
In the 70s, we were partying. Dennis was regarded as a notorious disruptor in Hollywood.
Ah, script, man. Just a blueprint.
God, look what you did, Dennis.
He'd been blacklisted.
He went into a downward spiral at that point.
I had to make a decision whether I was going to keep getting drunk at parties or whether I was going to make a movie.
And then came Dennis Hopper, who did not know his lines, but was right on and damn good at it.
Dennis and David Lynch, how would you characterize the way they worked together?
Famously.
He was absolutely perfect.
All right, it's nice to meet everybody.
Nice to meet you,
too. Just so you know, this is a podcast, and it's very, very conversational, not super...
Interviewee.
Yeah. Say that again?
Interviewee.
Exactly.
Let's turn our phone.
You're just kind of... Did you guys just get in from the airport?
No, but it feels like we got in from the airport.
Right.
We've been working so long on this and fighting to get here with the film. So we're...
And it's right down to the wire here because today is the opening day.
This is the opening.
The premiere today, theatrically speaking.
So what the podcast is called, Adam?
Great. I'm glad you asked. Film Wax Radio, Film Wax. So let me introduce everyone here. We have Satya Delamanitu, did I correctly?
Satya Delamanitu, that's me.
Delamanitu, who is
truly
the subject of the film for all intents and purposes. It's kind of funny because you have a subject who's not really no longer with us, but you're the guide, Satya.
Dennis
you're
is all pervasive.
Very true. I mean, yeah. Oh, it's actually sounds good. No, it sounds good. Thank you, though. And Sherry, what's your last name?
Simmons.
Timmons. Yeah. And Sherry Timmons is in the room. We may hear from Sherry. You know, it's like kind of like one of those Quaker ceremonies where all of a sudden if you feel the urge, you stand up and you say your thing. So that way it doesn't... I'm literally like hours from doing a Kickstarter campaign so I can like to buy new equipment because everything I have is it's like held together with spit and...
Chewing gum. That's kind of like our film.
Okay. Well, it looks a lot better than that. But this equipment does not look better than how I'm describing it. And last is Nick Ebling, who is the director of Along for the Ride. Is there a subtitle that I'm forgetting? Along for the Ride. And, you know, I love the film. I love I'm so happy to make this part of what I'm doing because...
How do you make a film about someone as prolific as Dennis Hopper. You know, we always felt you had to take a completely different approach to somebody as idiosyncratic and brilliant as him. And we, you know, Satya and I, we just had to do something special in tribute.
Right. For someone that
both changed both of our lives, you know, in different time periods.
Sure.
The film really focuses in the broader scheme. Your relationship with Dennis as his you know, essentially his right hand man, and you served in so many ways. You know, not only that, but as a friend, and you served in a lot of capacities. Is a good way to say it for Dennis in that relationship. Is that a fair way to put it? Or
Dennis and I were as close as any two men can be. Nick and I were both moved by the last movie. In fact, it changed both of our lives. And that's responsible for Nick and I's tightness and our commitment to making this film. The last movie is the impetus and the catalyst for our relationship and the creation of this project.
Yours and Nick's.
That's right.
Right. The last movie, okay, for those who aren't as familiar with Dennis Hopper's career, Dennis came off of this film, and this is what the documentary Along for the Ride focuses on, specifically this period of time. Coming out of Easy Rider, he had as much power as an actor could have, or a filmmaker, rather, could have, because it was such an enormous success, correct? And so what we do is we follow him into trying to make the last movie, which was going to be his big follow-up.
Yeah, I mean, as Satya would frame up Easy Rider, I mean, it was really the most, one of the most explosive films of that generation and really changed everything in Hollywood.
Yeah.
Well, kicked off the new Hollywood movement. You want to jump in for a second? And Satya will tell you that it was the first independent film to actually
be successful at the box office. It made money for Hollywood. Oh, wow. And that's the bottom line in Hollywood. There's a lot of independent films made before Easy Rider, but none of them had the impact at the box office that Easy Rider
and culturally, you know, the film, I mean, you know, stylistically, it, you know, not many people know that Dennis actually created the first modern rock and roll soundtrack, which has become the template for so many movies, because he didn't have any money to get Jerry Goldsmith, so he just started getting his friends, you know, and people that he knew in the scene.
Tom Preston, former president of MTV, came up to Dennis and I one day while we were dining at the Polo Lounge in Beverly Hills and said, "I'd like to introduce myself. I'm the president of MTV, and you gave me my job." There was no MTV before Easy Rider.
I can take both of them. Yeah, because it took the idea of image, moving image, and popular music. And that was really, with almost no exception, I mean, that was it, right? Because it had the Birds and everything else in that soundtrack.
Yeah, I mean,
amazing.
So many great bands were on that soundtrack. I mean,
yeah.
It just goes on and on. I mean, and that he landed that plane, that movie, I mean, I call it a plane in a way, like so perfectly at the time. It connected, like, you know, internationally, and it became an explosion. People had those middle finger posters, you know, up for, you know, all, you know, every, I think,
behind the Iron Curtain. Yeah.
Even beyond the Iron Curtain. But, like, okay, you know, it became a symbol. It became bigger than a film in a lot of ways.
Sure. Oh, yeah, absolutely. Yeah. Very few people are listening. Probably a significant number of people who might be listening would not realize just what an enormous impact Easy Rider had on the culture and how it changed the future of film, American films anyway. Well, no, even European films. Mm-hmm. Because before then, the biker movie was a big deal. Roger Corman, right before, right, he started earlier, like in the early mid '60s, probably leading up to it. And they didn't expect much more out of Easy Rider, but little did they know.
Well Dennis took it was brilliant because he took what was essentially an exploitation film genre.
Yeah, right. Exactly.
Went in there and turned it into a massive, sophisticated, you know, cultural movement,
and a statement about this country and where we were at that time. which nobody expected from Nick.
The Road movie was created by Dennis Hopper.
Is that right?
They're still doing it today.
Oh, yeah. Well, it's a cheap way to make a movie, for one thing, relatively speaking. Let's just make it. It's like, or make it in a log cabin in the woods if it's going to be a horror movie. It's just a one set type of thing. But it's a great thing. And people love the Road movie. But you're right. It was out of the studio and on the road. But for a little bit more background about your relationship, Satya, how did you guys meet? I apologize. First Dennis, and then I do want to ask you, Nick, about why this movie.
There's a lot of mystery about how Dennis and I met.
We're going to end it here.
Well, some people think we met at the hot springs in New Mexico. Some people think we met at a woman's apartment in Hollywood.
Mm-hmm.
Some people think we met at an art opening at the Dwan Gallery. And I don't really remember exactly when we met. It's one of those things where we were a mosaic, the two of us. We just clicked, Dennis and I.
Mm-hmm.
And I think one of the reasons that we were so tight is because I got in his face. And very few people had the nerve to go mano a mano with Dennis.
Uh-huh.
And because at the time he had this reputation of being a real cowboy, enfant terrible. And I like to think that I have some street smarts, which I imparted to him. And he gave me some sophistication that I lacked.
Was he done with, by that point, by the time of Easy Rider, was he completely done with the studio film? Because he started at the tail end of that period, or towards the end of it anyway, right? In terms of his acting career.
Well, that's interesting you say that, because Dennis wanted to make film, period. And his number one drive was he wanted to keep directing. I mean, he was a great actor,
yeah,
and he enjoyed acting. But his artistic...
Liar.
His artistic raison d'etre, uh-huh, was direction. And I think he was really, or I know he was really distressed that even though he won Sid Auk, the only award that they gave at the Venice Film Festival in 1971, the only award they gave, and most prestigious, as you know, the Venice Film Festival was the first film festival I ever created. And he was prouder of that than the Academy Award nominations.
Mm-hmm.
He was prouder of that than any artistic award or merit that he ever achieved.
What was the problem with the last movie then? I mean, by Hollywood's terms, by whatever conventions, why was it not a success?
Well, this is, you know, kind of the reason that the two of us, you know, came together to work, uh-huh, together. We both felt the same way about the last movie. See, the last movie, when Satya, you saw like a 15-hour cut in Taos, New Mexico in 1970, 71, somewhere around there, in Dennis's movie theater. And I saw it in 94 or 5 or 6 when I was a teenager, and it grabbed a hold of me just like, you know, 8 and a half grabs some people,
yeah,
or Husbands,
yeah,
grabs people, or Breathless, mm-hmm, grabs somebody. You, mm-hmm, know, that was the movie for me. And, you know, I found this just brilliant deconstructionist, you know, art film about Hollywood and Hollywood's responsibility to the world, and, you know, kind of, I just was blown away by it and studied it for years. And, you know, Satya felt, you know, very similar to me about it. And I think, you know, we went out on this journey because there wasn't a lot on it. There's some stuff in Easy Riders, Raging Bulls, you know, where the film
Peter
is...
Peter Biskin's book. Yeah,
yeah, which, yeah, is a great book, but it, you know, it somewhat dismisses the film and says a lot of things. And you know, I understand that Dennis, you know, fought the studio, but I also thought he made a great film, mm-hmm, at the end of the day. and it inspired me. And it's the reason I actually became an artist was when I saw that film.
Is that right?
Yeah.
How did you come to see it? I mean, where the circumstances, since you were a teenager?
Well, this is a long story, and actually Satya is involved in this story, which is just kind of was serendipitous, the whole thing. So in the early 90s or mid-90s, I was trying to be an actor. I had done a couple commercials. Mm-hmm. I got a support role in an AFI film, and I, you know, I grew up in Hollywood, and because my parents were kind of all of that, all of that embodies, I got to see a lot of movies I probably shouldn't have at a young age. My parents were pretty hip people, right? So I saw Blue Velvet when I was like 5 years old.
That's fucked up.
Yeah. It's totally fucked up, right? But
it's too early to meet Frank Booth.
I did, and I've been paying the price ever since. But, so these movies were a part of my life. Mm-hmm. And by the time I was like that age and I was acting, I was going back and, you know, checking those films out, and I saw Blue Velvet again, and, you know, acting wise, I mean, it's mm-hmm. amazing. He's amazing in that film, you know, and I wanted to do something like that. The problem was I was only 14, 15 years old. Nobody knew who I was. Sure. And there were only movies like Newsies that I was, you know, reading for at the time. There weren't any parts like that. And, you know, I think I was a little too far ahead of myself. So anyway, to make a long story longer, my parents took me out to Santa Anita Racetrack one day, mm-hmm. and Dennis Hopper was standing in the middle of the chandelier room, like right there smoking a cigar, and he was a star. You know, he was just holding the room, not saying anything.
Right.
You know, I'm sure you know that look, and I had to go say something.
How old again were you?
About 14 or 15 years old. Yeah. And I had to go say something to my hero. And I kind of mustered up...
courage?
The courage. And, you know, did the generic, yes, sir, I really love your... Mr. Hopper, I really love your work, and you're really genius. You know, I'm sure he heard that 20 times a day, 20 times an hour, whatever. And, you know, and the fact that he took the time and shook my hand meant a lot to me, even though I was probably just a kid bothering him. So what happened after that was I took off my blazer. I jumped on a bus when I got home. And I went down to a kind of infamous underground video store in Los Angeles that was completely amazing, called Rocket Video. I don't know if you're familiar with it or ever lived in Los Angeles, but...
No, I have not lived there, but I've been there a bunch of times.
20 years ago, that's the only place you could go see Tulane Blacktop, get a copy of it. Okay. That's where you could get Akira Kurosawa's, like, everything by him on videotape. It was that kind of place, and so I kind of went up to the slacker clerk, and I said, hey, are there any other Dennis Hopper movies that I should be looking at, like Blue Velvet? And mm-hmm. the guy pulled out this beat-up, sun-baked copy of this film called The Last Movie. And Hopper's smoking a cigarette, and he's got his foot up, and he's, you know, I'm like, let's check this out. And that's kind of how it happened. I put the tape in, and the tape didn't go back to Rocket Video. The late fees were still on my credit report as of 7 years ago until mm-hmm. I could finally pay it off. Yeah.
It's the most expensive VHS.
Yeah, I just, you know. I didn't even think to just go buy a copy, but you couldn't find one at the time.
No, you're right.
You couldn't. It was so hard to find the movie. You couldn't get it.
Amazon and
it wasn't there.
Whatever year that was, and
the studio squashed the movie.
Oh yeah. So you're suggesting? No, you're saying outright that there was something of a conspiracy to like kill that movie, make sure people could not see it, not get access to it.
Absolutely. Mm-hmm. There's no doubt about it. It was too edgy. They liked. They like the meat of the movie, the moguls.
Okay.
They like the essence of the film, mm-hmm. but they wanted him to change the ending. And the ending, Billy, the protagonist, mm-hmm. keeps dying more than once. And that was
You're
over.
Calling him Billy. He's Billy and Easy Rider.
Oh,
that's always Billy to you.
That's right. Yeah. Kansas, I'm sorry. Kansas. Thank you.
Thanks for catching that, Nick.
Kansas. Uh-huh. The protagonist in the last movie keeps dying. And that really got under the skin of the moguls. And they said, look, Dennis, we love your film, but you've got to change the ending. Dennis said, I've got Final Cut. Get out of the room. Mm-hmm. You don't do that to Lou Wasserman.
So he was going to get his revenge in one way or the other.
Well, I think also, you know, let me just contextualize a little of this for you from what
Please.
I've kind of found was that in 1970, Dennis Hopper was on the top of his game. I mean, mm-hmm. he was the golden boy American director, you know, and Hollywood was starting to shake hands with European style cinema. And so there was this explosion of creativity. I mean, this is like the.
Sure.
I mean, you have Bob Rafelson.
BBS was trying to get off the ground. Didn't last very long.
Zoetrope, Coppola is kind of launching.
Right, there was the promise was there, and the seeds were planted, so anything could happen. It was a very short period of time, that period of time, the art film, if it was going to make a lot of money, this was the time it was going to do it.
Yeah. And Dennis had a passion project that had been with him since the mid-60s, I think he did the script, but it had been with him a lot longer, you know, since he was making a film down in Mexico. What was that? The Sons
from
of Kid?
From
Hell to Texas. From Hell to Texas. And he had been formulating this idea. And he had also gone into a gallery in the late 50s and seen a totally experimental film called A Movie by Bruce Conner. You know, who's a great, great, brilliant, brilliant artist who worked in film. I mean, the list is amazing. He did one of the first Devo videos when they came to Los Angeles. I mean, just all kinds of. He had started in the 50s. You know, and this film had really grabbed Dennis and influenced him editing wise as well. I mean, there's a tons of experimental editing in Easy Rider. If you go and watch that film,
sure.
A lot of amazing stuff happening there.
I mean to get around to seeing it soon. It's gotten away from me all these years.
The last movie?
No.
Easy Rider?
Just kidding. Like,
right.
I watch it on a regular basis. I introduced it to my intern. It was like I showed him two movies.
Oh, I thought you were talking about the last movie. Oh, yeah, yeah. Okay.
I realized that, but then, No, I had an intern this summer, and I introduced him to Jules and Jim.
Nice.
Which I hadn't seen in many years anyway, so I was very happy to see it. And Easy Rider, that was it.
That's a good combination. That's pretty good. Yeah.
You must be a great person.
I'm really happy to be talking to you.
You must be a great person to intern for with your great taste.
That's a great question. And the answer is yes. No, thank you. Well, you know, it's cultivated over decades at this stage. So. But I, too, had to relate to you, Nick.
Mm-hmm.
I, too, had parents that were... You know, anti-establishment, anti-institution. I grew up on the mean streets of Forest Hills. Thank you, Sacha. Right. My listeners hear my tired jokes over and over, but you know, it amuses me. So anyway, but they were both artists, and they both had left New Jersey, you know, and moved to New York, and ultimately moved to the Village. But when my sister and I grew up, but in the meantime, growing up. They constantly were introducing me and my, you know, to Fellini and to, you know, Curse to Samurai films, to, you know, they loved all the Italians and the French filmmakers. So I grew up in Bergman, you know, so it was always on my radar growing up.
I think it's very cool, you know.
Yeah.
You
so I think I was
lucky.
Yeah, I think so too. Yeah. And, but, you know, so I, to discover Easy Rider or to become enchanted with it was set for that, you know. So I love it. I love going and seeing it over and over. And I always discover new things that I never knew before every
time
I
watch
it.
There's a lot in
there. There's a lot
in that film.
So Along for the Ride, which, by the way, when you're listening to this, it will have already opened, at least in New York. Mm-hmm. I want to get some more of this out of the way. It's opening where else theatrically? Is it in New York the only place...
In New York, we're doing we're doing the Metrograph for
at
a week,
which is brilliant because that's the place you're going to love it there, Sacha. Friday, November 3rd, which is
Friday, November 3rd, 7 p.m.
The Metrograph,
7 Ludlow Street.
That's right.
Yeah, he's got
and Lower East Side and the Metrograph. You're going to love going there tonight. It's a great spot. It's all about love and film, and this is the right film for the right theater.
Thank you very much.
Yeah,
we appreciate that. You know,
and they're very good programmers.
Yeah, no, we like Jake. He's a cool dude.
One of my
cool
campers from when I was a camp counselor.
Are you serious?
Yeah.
Wow.
Yeah.
He won the French Medal of Legion Award, I think. Legion of Honor Award, right?
To Jake?
Yeah.
A commitment to film.
Told. Yeah.
You know, he beat me again. And So the film, and then it's going to open in Los Angeles?
Yes. We're
going to
go. Los Angeles
was,
is... we're December 8th in L.A.
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
So this is good, too, because I can always use this again in December to kind of remind people and to keep people excited about seeing it.
And then San Francisco at the Roxy for, I think, a week or 2 weeks at the Roxy. And but a lot of the programmers are mounting retrospectives, too, of these films.
It's a great idea.
Yeah, they're doing the last movie tonight at Metrograph as well. Out of the Blue tomorrow night.
I love that movie, yeah. By the way, what's the young woman's, the girl's in that?
Linda Manns.
Linda Manns. Yeah. Satya, tell me, you must know, you must, you, do you have
Linda,
because she's like one of these incredible, like, you know, as a young girl, young woman.
Days of Heaven with Richard Gere.
She was also in that. She was the younger. Yeah, well, that's okay. But she could have been a Jodie Foster level or Tatum O'Neill, because it was around that time. But what happened?
I think she became a housewife and dropped out.
Worse than drugs, worse than alcohol, housewife.
I'm glad she dodged. She married a guy that was a prop man.
No.
Oh, right?
He was the second unit in the camera.
Second unit, right?
On Easy Rider. Named right, Bobby Guthrie. Right. They got married around that time in the early 80s, right after Out of the Blue, and they dropped out. They just didn't care. They had a family, raised horses, had a bunch of
suburbs.
Kids. Yeah, they're out in
the sticks, really.
Yeah.
She's okay. That's great to hear. Because she was just, you know, one of those dynamic child actors who, you know, which are rare and far and few in between, because who actually understand what they're, who really are as good an actor as the adults are. You don't see that too frequently. You see it, you know, very rarely with the children actors. But when you do, it's an incredible thing. And she's there, you know, she's just amazing in that movie, Out of the Blue, which is... Did you want to add something to it?
I just wanted to say, as a female growing up and seeing Linda Manns on the screen, she was such a I don't want to say role model, but such an alternative way of looking at this tomboy female. And I always wanted to be more like her, because all of the other, you know, teenage females were sort of, you know, doing their thing and rolling their hair and doing all that great stuff. And she had this great sort of tough denim-y persona that was always kind of magical.
Absolutely. At one time, we may have said she had a masculine energy. We don't say that anymore. But you understand why that would have been said at one time.
Absolutely.
In terms of her self-confidence in her performance. I don't know what she was dealing with in her personal life, but a confidence of performance comes through that's pretty amazing. That's why I wanted to bring it up. So your film, Nick, really... I'm going to say both of your film, because this is really a collaboration, would you say, between the two of you, that it really looks at that period, I would say, essentially, even though it does go to the end of his life, but the crux of the film along For the Ride looks at the period from after Easy Rider through Out of the Blue, this period where he was really at the top of his game, and then in director's jail or whatever you want to call it, kind of cast out of Hollywood, and then the slow reemergence back into... what would become one of the great stellar acting careers, frankly, in Hollywood?
Well, that's a great... that's great, because that's exactly what we were after. And
Mission accomplished.
Yeah, thanks, thanks. Oh, okay.
Yeah.
Well, I think for me, when Satya and I first... We met at Musso Frank's. We were brought together by
what?
A mutual friend.
Oh, mutual friends.
In Los Angeles, which is the oldest restaurant in Hollywood.
What's the name of it called?
Musso Frank.
Oh, Musso Frank.
Yeah, it's an old steakhouse and a place where you can get flannel cakes, you know, still, which is like something William Powell would have ordered in a movie in 1936.
Oh, really?
I mean, it's a magic place. It's where Dennis and James Dean used to hang out back in the day.
I remember like Ciro's, but I didn't know about Musso Frank.
It's definitely in that mm-hmm. thing. And we met, and I think Satya was so used to at that time, because I think Dennis had been gone maybe 4 years. At that point, four and a half years around the time we met, he was used, when he met people, they just wanted kind of maybe the abridged greatest hits of Dennis Hopper,
right,
you know, like
right.
this Easy Rider and Rebel Without a Cause, and you know, and then Speed,
and
I was like, wait a second, like
wait, what happened?
I'm like,
between?
Hey, there's a lot of time there, Satya.
Well,
like,
you know, well, what was the one? Hoosiers, wasn't it?
Hoosiers. So you got the Academy Award nomination.
Yeah,
yeah. Not my favorite film, but I'm happy.
It's very sentimental,
got,
but it still was part of his trajectory and his return.
Absolutely.
To you know the top, but of course Blue Velvet.
Uh-huh.
But American Friend.
Yeah.
That would not
he's
be
in. He's in the movie. He's in the
I have
the
to
American
watch it
Friend.
Again. I got a copy at home. I got to watch it again. I'll look for a sign.
I mean, that was part of hold on 1 second, sorry. That was part of, I think, even Satya's trajectory working for mm-hmm. Dennis. Eventually, it's like, they're just like, oh, we got to cast this guy. Wim Wenders wanted to cast Satya, you know?
Yeah,
I'll
well,
let you
I
jump
can see
in
why. He's
that.
Got. He's great.
I played Sam Fuller's bodyguard.
Oh.
In The American Friend. And
I always describe you as like a John Hughes. Houston hit every aspect of psychedelia, you know.
Right. Angelo was my name in the picture, my character's name. And
Dennis and Bruno Gans kill Saga in the movie near the end of the film, if you'll remember.
I guess it's been a long time since I've watched it.
And when I die, I did a peyote chant from my New Mexico Native American heritage.
Yeah.
And it was pretty tough. And we did about 12 takes after a 15-hour day on the waterfront in Hamburg, Germany, while it was drizzling, freezing cold.
It's always freezing.
And after the
damp
13th take, Wim Wenders came up to me and said, I need one more. And I did another take. And he said, that was better than Brando, Satya, but there was a hair in the gate. And we had to do another take. And Wim Wenders was one of the smartest, most erudite people I ever met in my life. And Dennis attest to that. And Dennis was really impressed with him. And the three of us became tight friends.
Yeah.
And one day, during the New York sequence, Vim showed up without his, he had a Citroen Maserati, and there was no Maserati. And everybody said to him, what happened to your Maserati? The crew.
Mm-hmm.
And he said, I sold it to buy Rostock.
To buy Rostock?
Film.
Oh, Rostock, yeah.
And,
I was thinking.
And
cheers.
By the way,
mm-hmm.
No one's getting paid. I want everybody to take a hiatus from their paycheck. And that was the only film, and I've worked on over 75 feature films, that the entire crew and cast worked without getting paid. And Vim paid us all in the end.
I understand.
But we had to suspend payment
because
he ran out of dough. Because
he bought all the film stock.
Yeah.
Amazing.
And I just never was on a picture where everybody
that
was
kind of loyalty.
So committed.
Yeah. Or should have been.
Everyone, yeah. You know, one of the reasons that they were so committed is Wim only hired directors. Peter Lilienthal, Nicholas Ray, Gerard Blanc, Sam Fuller. Just directors. Except for Bruno Gans, who was a stage actor.
Right.
He had
that was
never
his first
made
film.
A film.
Right. That was
he was
his
a great
film.
Actor.
Oh, my God. I
a
love
theatrical
Bruno Gans.
Actor, yeah. Not
he'll
a
remember
film.
From Wings of Desire, too, of course. Where
Wings of Desire.
It was his big
one
film.
Of the greatest films ever made.
Agreed.
Without a doubt.
Yeah.
Yeah, the American Friend really is one of the great Dennis Hopper performances, too, as well. And my favorite Wim Wenders movie, you know, hands down. Although I love Wings of Desire, too. But I guess I'm biased because Hopper's
Texas.
My hero. Oh, yeah. Well, there's
don't
that,
forget
too.
That
okay.
one.
I guess we're going to have that one.
I knew you were forgotten that
I had
one.
To tell you this. During
we're
the
in the
filming,
same mind, obviously.
During the filming of The American Friend, Dennis Hopper invented the selfie. I had to mention.
With what? The Polaroid. The Polaroid. Was he doing the Polaroids at that time?
He took the SX-70 camera, and he started taking pictures of him. So that was improvised, too. Yeah, I think... Was it your SX-70s or who? Or was it Robbie Mueller's SX-70? Like, what was the deal with it?
That was his cinematographer.
On the set, yeah. Yeah, and the film features Robbie Mueller's unseen set Polaroids, too, within the film as well.
Yeah.
They like, so many things in this film have never been seen. I think we uncovered 8,000 unseen images, and, there's Super 8 that's never been seen before that's in the film that we found. I mean, we looked in attics. We looked in basements. We looked everywhere.
There's
root cellar in New Mexico.
This is really more of a larger project, it sounds like, than just a documentary, you know, frankly.
Well, yeah. I mean, I think it just kind of enveloped our lives for 3.5 years. Mm-hmm. And, you know, there's talk now of doing a book because we shot 90 hours of footage and, you know, and there's all kinds of amazing things that couldn't make the cut, and there's images, and so we are kind of talking about trying to get more of that out there into the world and get people to see it and get turned on to all these great movies these guys did in the 70s and 80s, you know, while they were finding their way home.
During the American friend Dennis took my glasses. Oftentimes, he became me. In fact, one time, he was being interviewed and said, the interviewer asked him, where did you come up with Frank Booth? And he said, I'm playing Satya. And I, of course, I don't like that.
He's pretty much
my family
evil
was
guy.
Really revulsed when they heard that.
Yeah,
but
he's a mentally ill guy.
But not a school crossing guard.
No, not one that I want to trust crossing a busy street. Anyway, there's so much more to touch upon here. It's ridiculous. You know, as I think about it, barely touched on your. You know, go really the depth of your relationship and really kind of giving that the due it deserves. It must have been as big a loss as you lost it like a family.
I never recovered.
Yeah,
it was a irreplaceable loss, not only to me but to the artistic community. Mm-hmm. Dennis, that's one of the reasons we created this project. To make the public more aware of the multiplicity of Dennis's artistic creations. Dennis Hopper was not only an actor, not only a director, but a painter, a sculptor, an assemblage artist, a...
What was that last thing?
Assemblage?
Yeah, I'm sorry. I don't know what that is.
Put things together.
Oh, like objects. Got it. Okay. Assemblage. I see what it is. Okay.
Camouflage, assemblage.
Sure. Yeah, makes
subterfuge.
Sense.
They're all French.
Subterfuge. Sacre bleu. C'est formidable.
Hell fou.
How crazy. Whatever.
And another thing I wanted to bring up, too, that Dennis Hopper was a civil rights activist.
Mm-hmm.
Dennis Hopper was on the March to Selma with Dr. King. And his pictures of the Selma March are... unbeatable.
And that's a good segue into, his photography. I mean, people don't know. I mean, I guess some people know. But Dennis Hopper shot some of the greatest pictures of the 1960s, hands down. His eye is impeccable in so many mediums and so many things. And, I mean, I think we were trying to go, trying to shed light onto the last movie, and we wound up kind of, we opened the floodgates, really, because there's so much there. But we kind of felt that in a lot of ways the last movie was... Even though a lot of these things have been rediscovered, and there are art shows with the photographs, and his art has been championed, definitely in Europe and places like here in New York and stuff. But the last movie always seemed like it got forgotten about. And, I was so happy when, to know through so many of Hopper's friends that, and Satya, that he felt the last movie was maybe his greatest artistic achievement across all mediums. That was the thing he was the most proud of. And we just were trying to really... fight for that idea. That was the main thing for us.
When we lived in Taos, Dennis and I, Taos, New Mexico, that little art colony in northern New Mexico, nestled in the Sangre de Cristo Mountains,
mm-hmm.
Dennis showed me the unexpurgated version of the last movie. Dennis was so committed.
The 15-hour one?
Probably longer. But he was so committed to film. He bought a theater called the El Cortez and showed Battleship Potemkin, 8 and a half, Jules and Jim, The Throne of Blood, you name it, mm-hmm. every great art film. And there was a lot of room, a lot of seats vacant.
A lot of vacant seats.
It's interesting because, Hopper often gets, he often gets kind of... his reputation precedes himself. And, of course, there were the machine guns and the Playboy bunnies and all of the blow and the booze and all that stuff, was all true, times 10. But there is a hell of a lot more there, too, like the things Satya is talking about, like opening up the first, art house in Taos, New Mexico. He restored the Mabel Dodge Lujan house, which was an amazing historical, art commune in there, and put that place back together. It was falling down with his money from Easy Rider, and it's still standing today,
Mabel Dodge was the woman who put the money up for the first exhibition of abstract art in America that was here at the 69th Street Regiment Armory. And that was the that was in 1915. And that was the art show in which Marcel Duchamp, one of Dennis's heroes, and mine as well, first exhibited nude descending a staircase. And there was a huge controversy. In fact, the picture was banned, even though there was no overt nudity in the picture. The title itself scared the censors.
And you know, the Native Americans of the Taos Pueblo, Dennis was very much in their corner and gave them, you know, his support.
Dennis was a blood brother.
And was a blood brother of the tribe, you know. And many people don't know those things about him. I mean, there are so many indigenous people, and we found this in Peru where he shot the last movie. We found this in New Mexico on you know. And
in the Philippines, too. That's right. The Ithagal people in the Philippines who were the natives of the Philippines, they made Dennis Hopper a medicine man in their tribe.
Yeah, right. It's in the film. Yeah.
And Dennis became blood brother of the Pueblo Indians. And he's...
You just don't fill out a form and send away for that. That's something you got to earn, right? Really? Not to make light of it, but... Well, again, the movie's called Along for the Ride. Jump right in, Sherry. Don't be...
I just want to add, being the producer mind that I am, that our soundtrack was done by the fabulous Gemma Thompson. And Gemma Thompson comes from a band in Europe called the Savages. And it's an all-girl band. They're just simply fabulous and amazing. And it's her first soundtrack, and she's really done a great job. I just wanted to put that out there because
she's... Watch out for the vinyl.
Yeah, watch out for the vinyl that's coming.
Can you do me a favor? Right, maybe in your email or reminders, you know, I use interstitial music, and I love whenever I can promote an artist. If you can, you want to send a digital version of it, Dropbox it or whatever. I can include it in the podcast. Besides the trailer and all that, you know, even though it's an audio thing, it works really well. So I'm just going to urge everybody to make sure you see this film, and especially if you're, you know, obviously a Dennis Hopper fan. I think we've mentioned a bunch of films that were, tried to describe at the beginning of the conversation poorly, I can kind of try to now rephrase maybe a little bit better, which the film seems to be most interested in this period of time, or the works that were the most, you know, of his deepest artistic expression, whether it mostly came out in film, but was also there in photography and other forms of artwork.
Addendum, Dennis Hopper made the first film about gangs called Colors.
Oh, yeah, sure. That was his last directorial effort, or was the last film he did also did he direct? The last piece that he was working on?
Colors was the first movie with rap music. And it really helped propel.
Colors. I just remember that.
Right. Ice-T became.
You remember that?
Ice-T became a regular on broadcast TV.
Well, I think there were a couple other
thanks
movies,
to Dennis. The ripples.
They did not break the soundtracks. I think Colors was a big breakthrough. You know, because it was a studio. You know, picture.
Sure.
But what I just want to add one more thing. You know, this film became as much about Dennis as it did about Satya and you know, as well. And it's kind of a different take, I think, than most documentaries are these days. And I just wanted to kind of throw that in there. So, you know, it has a lot to do about friendship, this film, and believing in the art of your friend and supporting them and putting your own life on hold and in aid, you know. Satya is kind of an amazing kind of modern Sancho Panza, and really believed in Dennis and fought for him, and I think that that's a major part of the story.
Well done, yeah. Well, thank you guys. It seems like we're at a good point here. Promise that if you're in New York City, we'll pick it up again. I mean, there obviously is so much to talk about.
Yeah, you know, absolutely. And I think are we playing in the Brooklyn or Hudson or something like that?
Brooklyn or Hudson?
Yeah.
Oh, there's an Alamo Draft House there. Yeah. Is that where it's going to be?
Yeah.
That was the first one. There's one in Yonkers, and then now there's one in Brooklyn, which is, you know, recently opened. last
year. Yeah, we're going to try to take this on the road with Alamo at a few locations,
It makes a lot of sense, since they have a lot of, again, film lovers tend to go to the Alamo Draft House, and a movie about movies is always a nice...
A movie about a movie that's about a movie.
A movie, that's
about
true.
About a movie.
It is very...
Within a movie.
Very meta.
It's a movie.
Very meta in that regard. Thank you, Nick Ebling, and Satya De La Mana too, and Sherry Timmons, the producer, and see you along for the ride. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you, Dennis. Then I drift away.
Okay, once again, put it on your calendars tomorrow. Write yourself a reminder. Get one of the little alerts on your Apple Watch that there's going to be a Kickstarter launching tomorrow. But go vote first. And that's what's going to happen. And I'm very excited. We're going to be back again on Thursday with the following filmmakers. I have Shruti Ganguly. I've got Liam Meyerhoff returning to the podcast. And Minna Joseph returning. All three together in a conversation about gender parity, about a safe environment for both women and men in the workplace where they won't be harassed and the subject of predatory behavior. How do we accomplish that in this age? Hopefully this is the first of two conversations, at least, if not more. I want to do a panel, thanks to Leah's suggestion, with men as well. So I'm going to be trying to pull that off. But in the meantime, that'll be the next episode this coming Thursday. By then, the Kickstarter will be on its way, and we've got some enormous heavy hitters. We have, just to name a few, we have filmmaker Eric Schaefer, who, of course, has many, many films under his belt, and it was an indie pioneer going back to the, I would say, early 90s, correct? And then we have Henry Jaglom, another pioneer. We have Ira Deutschman, a pioneer. We've got just pioneers all month long. Ira Sachs. An hour, or it's like 45 minutes to an hour with Ira Sachs, the great filmmaker Ira Sachs. We have also cinematographer Sam Levy, who's the cinematographer of the current Greta Gerwig film, Lady Bird, which, if you haven't seen it yet, go check it out. It's a great movie. Read A.O. Scott's review. I think he refers to this movie as perfection. Indie perfection. I saw it myself at the New York Film Festival and could say, yeah, this is pretty close to what I would call perfection as far as like a contemporary, moving, funny, powerful, independent film. So kudos to Greta Gerwig, her cinematographer, and one who's also worked with Noah Baumbach in the past on a couple of films or several films. Again, Sam Levy, coming up on the podcast. Coming up, Tiffany and Jace Bartok regarding their documentary about the makeup artist Kevin O'Quan, because they are going to be at Doc NYC, so we're going to help sell some tickets for them. And Jace is a good friend. And Sheila Nevins, the president of HBO Documentary Films. Sheila Nevins. Seymour Wishman, also pioneer of independent film. He started the First Run Features many years back. He's going to be on the show. We have Giancarlo Esposito coming up on the show. Great actor. And you know what? I haven't even named everything, honestly. That's how much stuff I've got in the pipeline. So let's call this a day for now. Thank you for listening. Thank you to my friends at Rooftop Films. Thank you for hosting this podcast, digitally speaking. And thank you to the listeners who have continued to make this podcast a thing. I don't know how else to describe it, and supporting what I do. So thank you for that. That's it. Signing off here. Adam Shartoff, Film Wax Radio. Take care of yourself and the ones you love. Vote. Broken lines, broken strings, broken threads, broken springs.